I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Actor Christopher Reeve is being remembered today for his roles on screen and stage, but also, of course, for his contributions to spinal cord research. One of his physicians, Dr. Wise Young, spoke on the Today Show this morning soon after hearing of Reeve's death.
I am heartbroken. It does my heart good, however, to see him on the television screens here. You can see what he has done for the whole field.
Christopher Reeve died last night of complications from a pressure wound, an injury common in paralyzed people. The actor had been left paralyzed from the neck down after a 1995 fall from his horse. In an interview 2 years ago on NPR's Fresh Air, Reeve spoke of his life.
There's times when I just get so jealous, I have to admit. You know, I see somebody just get up out of a chair and stretch, and I go, no, you're not even thinking about what you're doing and how lucky you are to do that. So, no, I do the best I can, but I have moments where I wish just people don't take it for granted because, you know, God forbid, you know, you could slip on a wet floor and you'd be in my position in a heartbeat.
Christopher Reeve speaking on Fresh Air 2 years ago. Well, joining us on the line now is another one of Christopher Reeve's physicians, Dr. Raymond Anders. He's a surgeon at the University Hospitals of Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Anders, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Your thoughts, first of all, on hearing Christopher Reeve's death?
Well, it's a tough thing because he had become my friend over the 3 years that I've been treating him. Not only was he one of our patients in our investigational device for helping quadriplegics go off the ventilator, but he had also, you know, through his works in the Paralysis Foundation, with the Christopher Reeve Paralysis Foundation, he's really been a good spokesperson for this injury and for our researchers.
Yeah, most of his doctors are speaking of him that way. You used the phrase investigational device, and I don't think he'd mind that. Last year, you performed surgery on Christopher Reeve that, as you said, helped him breathe without a respirator. How unusual was that, and what kind of an investigational device was he?
He was a great patient for this. He was only our third patient. Our first patient required two operations, and our second patient, it did not work. And so he was the first patient that we were able to implant it successfully. Since then, we've actually implanted 9 further devices with a very good success rate in helping patients get off the ventilator. The device helps stimulate the diaphragm. The diaphragm is our large muscle that allows us to breathe. When you have a spinal cord injury, the connection between the brain's respiratory center that stimulates our muscles to breathe is gone from the spinal cord. So the muscles are intact and the nerves are intact, but there's just no stimulus that tells it when to breathe. So we implant electrodes on the diaphragm to help it tell when to breathe.
The New Yorker coined a term to describe Christopher Reeve's pressure on the scientific community and his willingness to be, you know, this investigational device for doctors such as yourself. They called it the Reeve effect. How would you describe that?
What I consider the Reeve effect is what many of us think, is that we need to do research faster. We need to get from the bench research and basic science to patients in a much more rapid fashion. I think that's what we're trying to do in our research. He also talks about the fact that as a famous person, everybody thinks he gets the first care for any new device, but in reality, most researchers are afraid to use a new device on a high-profile patient. Even in us, as we were debating on whether or not to do further patients before we implant Christopher Reeves, but he said, no, treat me like any other patient. I need, you know, I'm next on your list, and I'll take the chances just like any other patient would.
He has backed legislation which is now being considered by Congress. You're familiar with that?
Correct. The Christopher Reeve Paralysis Act, which would help fund research in this area and really help patients with quality of life, which has been one of his and his wife Dana's strong points, is the quality of life of people with quadriplegia.
Right. And also increase catastrophic insurance coverage for people in his situation. Christopher Reeve was also an advocate of embryonic stem cell research. Did that research advance at all because of his backing of it? I mean, you know that there are some people saying now that, well, we really don't know if there can be any success. Did he show us anything there?
Well, I think the thing that allows it, it allowed the public to debate the use of it. It even came up in the presidential debates last week, his name and the fact of stem cells. What we need is just discussion of it. Once you have a discussion, then people can make the right decision on what to do. If you don't have that discussion, nothing will be done. So by putting a face to this type of research, he allowed people to discuss it.
We understand also that the fact that he could gain some movement below his shoulders was something that scientists just thought was impossible. So in some ways, he did achieve the impossible.
What we're learning is as people get farther out with their injury, things are still occurring. The spinal cord is still healing. It's not a, you know, once you've had your injury, that's it forever. I think what he showed is that with good therapy, physical therapy, electrical stimulation, is that we can have some improvements many years after the injury.
Mm. We understand that people in his situation have a life expectancy of about 7 years.
Correct.
He lived 9 years after his accident?
Yes, which is a little bit more than expected, but many people, again, with an average, means 50% of people will be living longer than the 7 years.
Right. How big a loss? I mean, obviously it's a loss for everyone who came to know him and people who came to love him through his films and through the stand that he took, but how big a loss is his death for medical research?
Well, I think he just got the ball rolling. I think most researchers like myself will continue the work that we've been doing. We weren't just doing it for Christopher Reeves, we're doing it for all the patients. Hopefully his legacy will be that there will be some changes in the way that spinal cord research is done and that it will be done in a more rapid fashion.
Mm. And just before I let you go, any moments that you'd like to share with us? You had a particularly personal relationship, doctor-patient, but also sounds like friend-to-friend. Anything you'd like to share?
I mean, he really was a gentleman, and he understood the risk with research and the risk with being a part of groundbreaking aspects. He was willing to take the chance, just like any other patient involved in research.
Was he afraid?
No.
Yeah. I mean, it's cliche, but people are going to be saying it. I mean, he truly was a super man.
He was, and I feel privileged to have worked on him, and I feel privileged to have known him.
Mm. Dr. Raymond Anders, surgeon at the University Hospitals of Cleveland, Ohio, one of his patients, Christopher Reeve. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you.
An independent commission is being set up to answer questions raised by some of the candidates in this weekend's first-ever direct Afghan election. Millions of Afghans went to the polls this weekend in an election that was largely peaceful. Still, there were some calls to nullify the elections by candidates opposed to President Hamid Karzai, and there are concerns about the delivery of ballots. For an update, we turn to Scott Baldoff of the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us on the line from Kabul. And, Scott, we understand that the candidates who were angry about the elections have retracted some of their claims, but what were their concerns?
Well, the main concern was with the ink that was used to mark the thumbs of the voters. This ink was to prevent voters from voting twice or multiple times. And you might remember that some voters were able to obtain multiple registration cards, which are punched in order to keep them from voting twice. But if you have multiple cards, you could vote as many times as you have a card. But again, the ink is the way that you stop people from voting those multiple times. The problem with the ink was that it rubbed off. Mm. And some people were able to wash it off within minutes, and there was a concern, and there were charges that people were going back to the polls several times and casting vote for their candidates.
And so we understand there's been quite a bit of diplomacy since Saturday in helping the bruised feelings of some of these candidates. What's been happening?
Well, yes, indeed. We had multiple meetings by the U.S. ambassador, Zalmay Khalilzad, with a lot of the candidates, but not all of them. And also there were meetings with the United Nations representative here, Jean Arnault. The effort was to be able to say, look, we will listen to the charges, we will investigate the charges, but let's not invalidate this election.
Well, what is happening right now?
Well, at this point, there is a blue ribbon panel that has been named to go into the investigation process. There is going to be also the various candidates who had called for the boycott now will be allowed to cast votes. They had taken themselves out of that process. Now they have a chance to vote, presumably for themselves, and the vote counting will begin. Now, remember, this is going to take about 2 or 3 weeks, in part because these are all paper ballots. Also, because many of the ballot boxes are being brought in from very distant villages, sometimes by donkeys, sometimes by armed convoys, into regional centers where they will be counted. And that's going to take some time.
We understand that there were 36 attacks on the process reported, most of them unsuccessful. One act of violence was about the delivery of ballots. What happened there?
This was in Oruzgan province. There was an attack on a convoy, which had been very well protected. There were police, armed police, with this convoy. Some Taliban or presumed Taliban attacked the convoy, and three policemen were killed. The ballot boxes did make it to their destination. For the most part, though, security officials say that this was much less violence than they anticipated, and certainly it had none of the spectaculars that the Taliban had promised.
Right. In fact, it sounds rather heroic. You know, the ballots made it in despite the attack. How are Afghans feeling today about Saturday?
Among the voters that we talked to today, most of them were excited to have taken part in the process at all, and that this was their first real chance to choose a leader and to change a government without a civil war. There were some people who were concerned about the possibility of fraud. They were concerned about some of the allegations, and some of them were very angry at the candidates for raising this. They thought it was just a matter of the candidates being sore losers.
One of the top U.S. military officials in Afghanistan is quoted as saying that this election could be the death knell for the Taliban, which might then look to reconcile with the new government. Your thoughts on that?
Well, the security people that we talk to, of course, are patting themselves on the back for the good job they did. But they also warn that it's a little too early to be declaring the Taliban dead. Mind you, they are careful to stay on message. But they do say that, you know, with very high security on election day, it's not a surprise in some ways that the Taliban were not able to do more than they did. And clearly, the movement is still out there. The question is, will this election and what people think is high voter turnout be a matter of, that tells the Taliban they're no longer wanted?
Scott, I just want to switch gears with you for a second. I mean, you're in Afghanistan at an historic moment in its history. If you could, for us, just call up some of your impressions of Saturday, some of the moments that you saw.
They actually looked like they were going to a wedding, most of them. They dressed up in their finest in some polling stations. It was a bit of a fashion show. In other areas, they looked like they'd just been dragged out by the cat. But, you know, they were definitely enthused about what they were doing.
Scott Baldoff with the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you, Scott. Scott was speaking to us from Kabul in Afghanistan, where the general consensus is that after $200 million in aid and with thousands of international and Afghan observers, the election on Saturday went quite well. So when we come back, we'll find out more about what it was like at the polls. And did women vote? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've been talking about Saturday's Afghan elections, the first ever direct election for that country. And we turn now to Carlotta Gall of the New York Times. Where are you, Carlotta?
I'm back in Kabul. Mm-hmm. Just flew up today from the south of Afghanistan, from Kandahar, which is where I was for the whole of the election.
We understand, in fact, a little bit south of Kandahar. So tell us, what did you find in the village that you visited?
Well, it was terrific. We drove out about half an hour from Kandahar, but in an area that's completely Taliban, or has had a lot of Taliban. And we found, you know, people just setting up and queues of people coming out, all the villagers. Very excited, very happy, a kind of party atmosphere, lots of joking. You know, in these rural areas, everyone knows everyone, so it was actually very informal. And excited. There were a lot of old people who were very proud and excited to be voting.
Yeah.
It was a nice feeling.
What were, you know, they saying about the candidates?
Well, they almost all voted for President Karzai because he's their fellow Pashtun. So you've got a lot of, I'm voting for my fellow Pashtun, we know him, we know his father, he's from, you know, our region, and that sort of thing. But there was there were a few people voting for others, and there's quite a lot of joshing and joking. One chap did say, he, you know, why aren't you voting for Auntie, which meant the one female candidate.
Why did
they quickly quipped back that she's at home making bread, which is a typical attitude of them down there. The women are always at home working.
Why did they call the one female candidate Auntie?
It's a sort of respectful term to call any woman Auntie. If they address a woman, they'll say Auntie. So it was a sort of respectful term. And then the reference to her, she's at home making bread, was a reference to her campaign poster. She selected as the symbol a wheat stalk and a piece of Afghan flat bread. So it showed that they were all aware of the candidates, I think, and all having fun. So there was quite a lot of, you know, happiness and joking, really, but certainly a feeling that everyone was engaged and interested, and that they'd all been listening to the radio and they knew what was going on.
Any sense of their feelings about Hamid Karzai, the interim president, being handpicked by the United States?
Yes, you did get that. And in fact, you even got some of the, sometimes the older or the more simple people saying, you know, we'll vote for him because he is the president, or we'll vote for him because he's the one approved already or approved by the foreigners. But I think most people were voting very freely because they do think the last 3 years have been an improvement on the previous 25 years of fighting, and so they're giving him their vote of confidence. They were pretty sharp, I felt, all their comments. And so it was a vote of hope as well for more progress.
Did you see any women voting?
Well, unfortunately, the village I chose, and I actually went to two villages sort of quite close to each other, there were no women voting, and no women had actually registered, so they weren't able to vote, even if they opened a polling station. And so we didn't see any women outside the houses, except I found three women walking from one village to another in their burqas, and so I stopped and talked to them, and they were pretty annoyed. They were very angry with their menfolk for not allowing them to register and not giving them the chance to vote. And they knew all about it. You know, one woman said to me, you know, everyone's talking about the election. We all know it's going on, and we wanted to take part, and we wanted to vote for Karzai because he's a man from our region, and we know him and trust him. You know, so that was rather sad. In other places, though, even in the south, you know, the women were voting, but more in the sort of towns and the cities where people are more educated. In the rural areas, as I say, where I was, no women voted at all.
What did the men say about that?
They looked a bit sheepish, actually. I mean, some, certainly, you know, the head of the group, he said, oh, well, the registration people didn't come. But the others, you know, I talked to a tractor driver, I remember, and some of the other farmers, and they just said, no way, it's not in our culture, the women don't leave the house. So I think it was a very traditional area that I went to, and as I mentioned, it was strongly Taliban and still does have sympathies with the Taliban.
Yeah. Carlotta Gall, I'm imagining that you and other reporters were girding for violence because that's what was expected. Were you surprised at what you found?
We were, because there were so many security alarms and so much security. I mean, it was phenomenal, the clampdown. They stopped all vehicles basically for 2 days in the cities and on the roads. And we and the police were the only people driving around. We got special passes. Certainly the coalition and the Afghan security forces really took it seriously, which made us think they must know something. I think the heavy security probably prevented some things, but possibly the message got through to either the Pakistanis or the Taliban leaders in Pakistan to not mess up on this one, to not interfere. Something held them back, I think.
Well, and maybe the enormity of a democratic election and a people who are doing it for the first time.
Yeah, it was very, it's very moving, and you can see a lot of people are hoping that things will change. And it was nice to see this, you know, new experiment in democracy for them. A lot of them said, this system's a good system, our old system, you know, there was always someone who could use more force or you will cheat or, you know, they had always had a system of local councils electing by vote or in public discussion. And they're very happy with the idea of the secret ballot and everyone has a vote, even the lowliest and the poorest man.
Yeah.
Maybe the Taliban also picked up on this enthusiasm and perhaps realized it would be stupid to mess this one up.
Yeah. Carlotta Gall, reporter for the New York Times, speaking to us from Kabul in Afghanistan. Carlotta, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, The Choice. The PBS series Frontline examines the lives of George Bush and John Kerry. And billionaire George Soros, by some estimates, he's spending $25 million of his own money to beat George Bush. We'll ask, is that fair play? Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Many nursing homes across the country are reporting they have no flu vaccines for their elderly patients, the segment of the population most in need of the vaccine. The recent shortage came about because of a tainted batch at a manufacturing plant in Great Britain, but it comes at a time when nursing homes are already hit by a lack of resources and high employee turnover rates. And as the population ages, that can only get worse. Tom Gass has devoted his life to social work and caring for the elderly. He's written about his experiences in the book Nobody's Home, Candid Reflections of a Nursing Home Aide. Tom spoke to us earlier this year from the studios of KSMU in Springfield, Missouri, and he began by describing his views of nursing homes.
I would say it's a paradoxical thing. We tend to not want to look at this part of life because it's innately unattractive, but that's to our own detriment when we do that because the elderly have a great deal to offer us. And we have a great deal to offer them. And the way that our society seems to be setting itself up is to separate out the people who we no longer seem useful or create difficulties for us.
Well, you have written much constructive criticism for the industry, but also, as we said, the stories that you tell of actually, you know, your feet on the ground work on the wards. Why did you decide to become a nursing home aide?
I had been living in Asia. I was teaching in Japan. My mother found out that she was diagnosed with terminal cancer. So I came back here and I stayed with her and assisted her in her death. And that was a transforming experience. And following that, I wanted to do good work, you know.
And as an expert writes in an introduction to your book, you're entering a world that is poorly paid, physically demanding, emotionally exhausting, intellectually stultifying, at the bottom of an irrationally hierarchical power structure, and quite literally, well, I won't read the phrase, but, you know, full of...
Yeah.
full
yeah.
of...
The assaults on the senses that occur in a nursing home are the first thing that hits you. But we break down barriers. We become closer than our normal social interactions will allow. And the people there, the overriding reality in nursing homes is loneliness, you know. And so we have these yearning hearts reaching out just for that sense of human connection.
which you make. I mean, the stories of the residents who, you know, the one who's streaking her hair with toothpaste and the others who, these are, you know, people in some of the worst physical and mental states, which is why they are in this relatively, you know, good nursing home. I was thinking that for people who have relatives in nursing homes, as painful as it is to read this, how heartening to know that someone like you was there. Do you think you represent most of the nurses' aides?
In everyone, I saw moments of tenderness and caring. The most heartening experience were the family members who we'd see every day, in and out, spending with loved ones who often didn't even recognize them.
But the conditions themselves, what are you saying? Because as you know, so many people have a fear of nursing homes. And you write, that flecked throughout the book are comments about the nursing home industry, that a nursing home with 130 beds can gross about $3 million a year. That's, your boss was making $3 million. Mm-hmm. You were making $6.90 an hour, that residents can spend $60,000 to $95,000 a year on care. The doctors are often just, instead of visiting patients, they visit the patient's charts because they're not paid enough by Medicaid to spend the time.
I don't have the solutions. I'm not a policymaker. But what I am saying is, that to solve any problem, the first step is we have to look squarely at the reality. We have to look at things as they are. And that's the value of the book that I see, is that it just lays out, this is what's happening.
But take one example. Should the nursing home industry be only not-for-profit? That $3 million that's going to the boss, could it be better spent on the patients? Or are the patients always going to be, you know, for at least a part of the time, sleeping in their waste because it's inevitable?
I think that's both true.
Mm-hmm.
There are conditions of our human nature, biological nature, which we ought to learn to accept, you know, instead of concentrating on Botox and all these things to try to pretend that we're younger than we are. And the second theme is that it appears to me that there is a built-in and inevitable conflict of interest between the extent of care and profit in the for-profit system. Our owners came in, and they were, I heard them say often, well, we can't afford this, we can't afford that, you know. If we can use the national figures, the average profit margin, these people were bringing home $500,000 to $600,000 a year.
Salary.
And it's in my personal judgment, I couldn't possibly be enjoying that much money if I had a clear vision of what, you know, what difference it could have made to so many people.
Hmm.
You know, if we just had greater staffing levels, would have made a lot of difference.
You also write that long-term care industry is the most heavily regulated in America, next to nuclear fusion, and that a lot of the regulations that are put in place really don't help the patients and don't help your job and are more bureaucracy than are needed, take nurses away from actually doing their work, and instead they're doing paperwork. You give so many examples. What's the one thing you would want to say out loud, even if it's a small thing, that would make the life of a resident of a nursing home and a nurse's aide better?
If there was one thing I could do that wasn't done, I never saw anyone recognized for an act of kindness and caring. It's set off the charts, off the screen of our awareness, because we're running a business.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, that might improve the 71% turnover rate at most nursing homes.
Yeah. And I just found out recently that OSHA says that nursing home aides lead in muscular skeletal injuries than any other group in the workforce.
Well, Thomas, you say in a beautiful section of the book that you took the job in the hopes that you might somehow purchase your own goodness.
Yeah.
Did you?
It taught me that to be more open-hearted, and it taught me that if you just allow that emotion to flow, you can, at least for a moment, you can release them from the prison that they live in.
Well, Tom, thank you.
Okay.
Our recent conversation with Tom Gass, a former nursing home aide, and of course, his descriptions of the elderly in nursing homes don't apply to all the elderly or to all nursing homes. His book is called Candid Reflections of a Nursing Home Aide. As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, feeling a little bit out of touch? Listen up, we're going to have the latest in hip-hop slang. It's incomprehensible to me. You are listening to Here and Now. He's not welcome at the debates. He's still struggling to get his name on the ballot in several states. But last week, Ralph Nader, the independent presidential candidate, was welcomed at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He spoke to students, and what follows is a few minutes of what Ralph Nader said.
In their lust for monopoly power, the two parties now are carving up congressional and state legislative districts with computer precision so that only one of them dominates the election. So people are voting here in Massachusetts. 60% of your state legislators will run for re-election without any opponent. Is that an election? That's not an election. That's a selection. An election means a selection. That is a coronation. At the congressional level, almost 95% of House seats have been redistricted or otherwise into Republican or Democratic dominated districts. The voters have been disenfranchised. Now, when you hear this, I can guarantee you by my prior experience that your metabolism has not gone up one iota, because we've become numbed by the disintegration of our democratic society, in part because all of you are going to go into the ruling classes, except for a few rebels and revolutionaries. You're right now in the top 1 or 2% of people your age in the world in terms of your health, education, ability to make a difference, and likelihood of being slotted in by virtue of your diploma from Harvard University into the upper levels of the oligarchy and plutocracy. So why should you be worried? It's working very well for you. Harvard Law School is nothing but a high-priced tool factory for corporate law firms. It was when I was there, and the price has gone up very substantially since in terms of tuition, in terms of what brand new law school graduates who don't know what a process server looks like, bringing down $120,000 a year, $130,000 a year. You see what I mean by slotting into the oligarchy and plutocracy? What is their socially redeeming work when they work for Ropes Gray or Cahill Gordon or Covington and Burling or any of these giant corporate law factories? I was at an airport in Tampa just before the hurricane, first hurricane came, and I had time to spend just sitting there. I went and bought one of these nutrition bars for $2.80. And I went to the cash register woman, and I said, "That's pretty high price. They must pay you a good wage." And she was a middle-aged woman, and she gave me the saddest look and said, "They start us at $6 an hour. $6 an hour is just a little over $11,000 a year, which is what a brand new law student makes in a month." Yeah, it doesn't seem to bother the liberal intelligentsia that the differential in wealth in this country is destroying our society. When 47 million full-time workers, one out of every three, are making less than $10 an hour, Walmart wages $5.50, $6, $7, $8, $9 an hour before payroll deductions, no way one person can live on that, much less a family. The whole history in America of wage slavery and the struggle against wage slavery in the 19th and early 20th century, defined as earning wages you can't possibly live on, is now come full circle. And many of these people work for companies whose chief executives are making $7,000 an hour.
a portion of what independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader had to say last week at Harvard's Kennedy School. Well, staying with politics, I made a mistake last week, and it was a doozy. I quoted candidate John Kerry saying, "Whom among us doesn't love NASCAR?" But as many of you wrote to say, he never said that. As the Daily Howler website points out, New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd put those words in Kerry's mouth after hearing them secondhand from a friend. An NPR reporter recorded Kerry's actual words on the campaign trail. He was chastising President Bush for starting cars instead of jump-starting jobs.
This president went to Florida just the other day to start the NASCAR races. There isn't one of us here who doesn't like NASCAR and who isn't a fan.
And Kerry continued speaking about job loss. So he actually said, there isn't one of us here who doesn't like NASCAR and isn't a fan. Not the more elitist and grammatically incorrect, whom among us doesn't love NASCAR. So I ask for your forgiveness. After all, who among us has not made a mistake? Stay there. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Walt Whitman called slang the people's poetry, but if you're not down with the Mad Sick street talk, it may sound more like foreign language than urban art form. So today we're offering a primer on slang that you should find straight crunk. To help us out, we're joined by Jen Billick, president of Knock Knock, a Venice, California company that's produced slang flashcards. It's a collection of 60 off-the-hook references to the modern American lexicon. Jen, off-the-hook?
Indeed. It means fun, enjoyable, out of control, amazing, very positive.
There you go. Okay, we are going to be off the hook. How did you do research for this? What did you do?
We came at it from a number of directions. We did a sort of field research out in the malls and 7-Eleven parking lots and asked people what kinds of slang they were using these days. We also looked in various places on the internet. We went to sort of youth magazines and rented a lot of not great movies.
And now we have these flashcards. I'm looking at some. On one side you have the word, and the other sort of this retro illustration. For instance, I've got a card that says cheddar, and on the other side, this illustration is sort of a 50s retro of two women talking to each other, and the caption underneath says, "The nose job cost mad cheddar, but I haven't regretted it once." And then there's the definition. Mad cheddar?
A lot of money.
What's your goal here?
Primarily it's fun. You know, that they're a really enjoyable stroll through the way that our language is growing and changing all the time. And then two is a slightly subversive goal, which is pairing these very sort of urban terms with the sort of whitest of white bread pictures, which you alluded to. And the tension between the two, I think, really yields humor.
Well, Jen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to continue our talk with Mike Adams. He's a linguist at North Carolina State University. He joins us on the line now. Mike, are these old words being used in a new way? New words? What are they?
Sometimes they're new, and sometimes they're old used in a new way, and sometimes they're old used just in the old way.
Okay, well, let's take a listen. We've had some people help us by reading the captions on the cards. Here's the first one.
You straight killed it on that last hole.
That's the card for the word straight. You see two sort of well-heeled country club types walking away from a golf hole. And you straight killed it. Straight meaning straight up?
Probably that's what it comes from. It's probably just straight up with that adverb missing at the end, yeah.
And what about killed it?
Well, killed it is something most of us, I think, are familiar with. I mean, he killed that performance. He killed that whatever it was, sort of in the sense that we use nailed today. And that sense of the word's been around for at least a century, so that's not really new. What's new is the combination with straight.
All right, let's look at another combination of words.
You drive way too fast. I had to dime you out.
Can you tell people around here are not used to using these words? But a drop and a dime on somebody, that's an old phrase.
It's pretty old. It's 1960s, maybe a little bit earlier than that. What's different is that you could dime somebody or drop a dime on someone in the 60s, and the diming out sounds like it's turned into a phrase like freak out, chill out, bail out, or any of those phrases, and that development is probably pretty recent.
Well, onward. Let's go to another one. I mean, most of these are new to me, but this one's been around for a while.
Oh, you think you're such a Mac.
Mac being?
Well, in this case, it means probably somebody who's really good at flirting with women, or somebody who's presenting himself sort of sexually. But originally, it seems to have meant pimp. That word probably popped up as early as 1887. That's okay. The first record we have of it.
Here's another word that has been used before in a different context. Let's listen.
Word on the circuit is you've got beef with me.
People just, and beef. Beef we've heard before. Where's the beef?
Well, right. And I have heard a lot of slang in my time because it's what I study every day. But this card was new for me. I had not heard beef used this way. It used to be that you'd say, she has a beef with me, or you've got a beef with me. And we usually think of slang as words. But what's slangy about this, I think, is that that article dropped out, and it's just beef. You've got beef with me, and that's what makes it sound zippy and zany and new and sort of breaks the rule.
You know, we've been talking about how some of these words are familiar. I'm thinking of grip, for instance.
Put a grip of sugar in my coffee. That's how I stay so mad sweet.
Grip is a word that's been around. So some of these words, they evolve. They might have been your parents' words. And you use them differently.
They might be that, or maybe they're words that, because you want to annoy your parents, you decide to use in a way they won't accept.
Let's play some more.
Yo, little dog, daddy's got to bounce.
Okay, where shall we start there? Bounce, dog?
Well, dog's a tough one, and I have to admit, I mean, dog's been used for a companion, a friend, somebody that you think of as less significant than yourself for a long time, but the dog, D-A-W-G, that's coming out in that card is sort of hip-hop slang, the street that you were talking about before, that's become pretty general by now. There are lots of people who would say that outside of the hip-hop community. When I say lots of people, probably not that many, but some.
Yeah, I mean, let me ask you about that again, because, yes, most of these words do come from the hip-hop community, and this has happened so many times with hip-hop and with urban culture that mm-hmm. it gets co-opted and sold, and people make money on it, and then they have to go and be creative and come up with something else.
So that's exactly right. So you could say the commercial and the commodity drive on the creation of new language today in ways that it certainly wouldn't have done 100 years ago. Because communities we can reach into communities or learn from communities.
Or steal.
Yeah.
Or steal from
them,
frankly.
Or steal,
right.
If you want
right.
to look at it that way.
And
sure.
forces new language to come out.
Yeah.
Well, let's close with what I understand is your favorite.
Okay.
I can assure you that the Tupperware party will be mad crunk.
The illustration is a woman, they're both in pearls, a woman addressing another woman. They're sitting at this fancy table discussing the Tupperware party. I can assure you that it will be mad crunk.
Yeah.
Where's that crunk?
Well, there's an old word, crunk, that comes from Icelandic that means the cry of the raven, but I doubt that this word has anything to do with that. I think probably it's just made up in our own time. And when Walt Whitman said that slang was a type of everyday poetry and belonged to the people, I think it's words like that and like bounce. You know, you could say, I'm just going to go somewhere. No, not just I'm going to go, but I'm going to bounce. People who don't like to study poetry in school and don't have much time for metaphor, use metaphor in their daily language anyway, and fun sounding words like crunk.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I got to bounce.
Me too.
But it's been real sick.
it's been mad crunk to talk to you too.
Mike Adams is a linguist at North Carolina State University. We also spoke with Jen Billick of Knock Knock, the California firm that produces slang flashcards. You can check out more of their straight crunk phrases by going to our website, here-now.org.
This new policy against stripes is whack. I'm making some sick hors d'oeuvres for the book club tonight.
I'm not sure this will work. You ready? Yo, little dog. No, I can't read it. Once again, it's Daug.
And they're supposed to be nonsensical?
Yeah.
The nose job cost mad cheddar.
What do you say we jack these office supplies and go back to my crib?
Put a grip of sugar in my coffee? That's how I stay so mad, sweet?
What does that mean?
So hip. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.